So my talk is going to be on the title, Dimensions of the Bodhisattva. And it's about the Bodhisattva ideal, which is a central part of Buddhism, particularly Mahayana Buddhism, the great vehicle. And most of you will probably know about the Bodhisattva in different ways, in different contexts, different settings. So you might know of the archetypal or transcendental bodhisattvas that we see in art, Avalokiteshvara and Manjushri and so on. You might know of the bodhisattva as being something not up there, but actually to do with me and my spiritual life. It's a way of talking about what we're doing in practicing the Dharma. Maybe it's connected for you with compassion. It might also be connected with the Buddha. So there are lots of different bits of the Bodhisattva ideal. And in this class, we're going to be exploring it in quite a number of ways. It's an incredibly rich topic. We could keep going with this for a long time. There's something about the Buddha that I find so engaging, which is the sense that he was a human being, but that he had explored his humanity to a point where it becomes something else. And what that means is that my humanity and your humanity can also become something that goes beyond our limitations. In other words, our minds we have a particular perspective on life, but there are things beyond that perspective. And the Buddha, he's not only the symbol of those things in the abstract, he actually is the person who experienced them for himself. So, well, Santi's sculpture will be finished at some point towards the end of the year. He's currently, he's created the large image. He's currently placing the hairs in the head one at a time. Thousands and thousands of them.
How would you spell his name?
Santi, and S-U-N-T-I. And he does have a long Thai surname, which I have not yet been able to master. Which, if you consider that I go by the name Vishwapani Blomfield, isn't very good on my part. But I cannot say his surname. Anyway, so it will eventually be public, and I think it'll become a very, very famous image. So, but what I want to pick up is that sense of the Buddha being human and being more than human. And we can talk about whether the Buddha is really just a human with another dimension, or if he's a being of another dimension who kind of has a human form. But he's both for me, and that's why he is such a powerful figure, and the myths of Buddhism grow from that. The basic story that Buddhism tells, and it tells it through its teachings and through its mythology, is that human beings can follow a path towards enlightenment. We don't actually need to know what enlightenment is in order to A, start heading in that direction, and B, be inspired by it. We don't need to know, and I'm not going to try and pin that down or define it or anything like that. But that's the central myth of Buddhism and the core of its teaching, the human path to enlightenment or awakening. And another word for that path is the Bodhisattva path. The Buddhist path, actually in all traditions, is the Bodhisattva path, but it comes to have a particular meaning in Mahayana Buddhism. So, and this Bodhisattva version of the Buddhist path is, in my view, and not just mine, the most magnificent ideal that's ever been held up before human beings. So the first Bodhisattva, looking at things in terms of how Buddhism developed, is Gotama. Bodhisattva in the early Buddhist sources, in the early discourses, simply means the being who is heading for enlightenment. So there are a number of these suttas, they're called in Pali, or discourses, we say, in which the Buddha tells stories about the experiences that led him towards enlightenment. And he says, when I was a young, unenlightened bodhisattva, and then he'll tell a story about what that happened. And quite a lot of those stories are very famous. There's a story about him starving himself and becoming an ascetic. There's why he stopped doing that, and stories about him discovering the middle way, and so on. So there are quite a number of stories. Not actually that many of them. It's quite a manageable sort of range of things to read by comparison with what comes later. And that's the Bodhisattva. And later on, in other Buddhist texts, that story about the Buddha is greatly elaborated into, he becomes a very heroic figure, and sort of a figure of fable and legend. And actually, a lot of the versions of the life of the Buddha that we know really are based on those legendary sources. So things like the four sites, where the Buddha is living in a palace and he's completely secluded from anything that might cause him pain or suffering. And then he goes out of the palace and for the first time ever sees an old man, a sick man and a dead man. And then finally sees another figure who embodies the spiritual path, a Shramana. Those stories are later elaborations around the basic story, which is much simpler than that. Nonetheless, that's part of the legacy. In the early sources, the Buddha is basically, in his way to enlightenment, he's basically doing it because he wants to understand the meaning of life and the nature of suffering. He's not actually doing it for the sake of other beings. So in a text called the Arya Pariyesana Sutta, the Noble Quest, we have the story that after his enlightenment, he thinks, whew, great, I've done it. Maybe I'll just stay here. No one's going to understand what I've got to say. And then Brahma, which basically means God in Indian mythology, comes to him and says, No, don't do that. No, you've got it. Everyone needs this. And the Buddha then has a vision where he sees all of humanity as a bed of lotuses, different stages of unfoldment. And he sees, in other words, a vision of human potential, and that some people will get it, this teaching of his. And other people will get it a little bit, and others won't, but maybe they're like lotuses in the mud, and they'll come up, and then they'll get it. And so everyone, human life, in other words, is this process of unfoldment, like being a lotus bud caught in the mud, sunk in the mud, but capable of flowering. So we have that element of the Buddha. There's this kind of basis of compassion, but the compassion is mainly expressed after his enlightenment. He teaches for 45 years. Now, as the legends develop, what you find is that the progress that the earlier sources describe on his way to enlightenment is sort of got less and less emphasis. And in many of those legendary lives, you really have the idea that he was enlightened before, at the moment of his birth. He was already enlightened. And the whole paraphernalia of his asceticism and all of that, all the things that happened on the path, are just a kind of show for the benefit of ordinary beings. but actually he's not really changing. He's sort of manifesting something that's already there. And this became a very strong part of the way the Buddhist story was told. In Christian theology, you call this docetic, the idea that Jesus was just kind of going through the passion in order to, as a way of educating people. And you have the same idea, really, developing in Buddhism. But that raises a question. That raises quite a big question once you start to think about the Buddha in these very mythologized terms as this transcendental figure. How did he get to be like that? And if we can't answer that question, what's the relevance to you or me? He becomes a god. He becomes a figure on a shrine who we worship in the way that everyone worships their gods. You know, every religion does that. But what's his connection to me? So what then happens in the Buddhist tradition is people got really interested in the Buddha's previous lives. So in Buddhism, you have this idea of rebirth. And they started to tell stories about his previous lives, in which he'd been in all sorts of situations and all sorts of forms. So a lot of these are animal stories. And they're actually adopted, many of them from... some of them are adopted from Indian mythology. Some of them are sort of pick up little bits in the Buddha's and things that the Buddha said, little stories he told. He actually in the discourses there are about 35 or so Jatakas, stories of his previous lives. But in the full text, you have 530 something of them. So there, this vast literature, actually, the Jatakas, and it's lovely. I've read. You get the little children's versions of them, and I've read some to my son over the years. You got this kind of cartoon book of deer stories where the Buddha is reborn as a deer, and the deer sacrifices itself, and that becomes a way of telling a story about how the Buddha developed a range of qualities. You know, so he develops the qualities of compassion, of generosity, and so on. And all of this is happening over this vast scale of many, many lifetimes. So thousands of years, maybe tens of thousands of years. It's really going to take a long time to get enlightened, folks, so you better start feeding our bodies to the rabbits. That probably needs a bit of explanation. But what the Buddha's doing is what's happening in the Jatakas is the idea of this bodhisattva path emerges. And eventually this becomes formulated as the cultivation of a number of virtues. They're called paramitas or perfections. Sometimes there are six, sometimes there are ten. The six paramitas are generosity, ethics, patience, energy, meditation, and wisdom. And there are others as well in the longer lists. But those are really important parts of the Buddhist teachings. And focusing on them in this way is also a way of saying that there's more to practicing Buddhism than just gaining wisdom. You know, understanding, like, I've got the meaning of life. Oh, no. You need to start with cultivating these virtues. And that's the idea. The Buddha did that over all of these lifetimes. He practiced generosity. He practiced ethical behaviour. He practiced patience. And in these fables, the patience is very extreme. You know, he's able to withstand pain and so on. And then he practices energy and effort. He plumbs steps of meditation. Then he gains wisdom. And so the bodhisattva path is one that includes all of this. And it includes not just abandoning our faults and our defilements, but cultivating these virtues. And so the bodhisattva path is a path of cultivation. Then the Buddha, Another thing that happens, actually, in all of the sources, in all the traditions, is the idea that a number of lifetimes ago, not that many lifetimes ago, the Buddha was a monk, a Buddhist monk, in relation to a previous Buddha. So this is another bit of this whole legendary side of Buddhism, the idea that there's been this succession of Buddhas down the ages, and that our Buddha is just the latest one in this succession. And that in... So the Buddha was a disciple of the previous Buddha, who's called Kashyapa. And he made a vow to Kashyapa that he would gain enlightenment. So that is the origin of the Bodhisattva vow. And the Bodhisattva vow then in the Mahayana late becomes this very important thing. And it becomes a way of talking about our fundamental intentions. It's the Bodhisattva figure that emerges from all of this material and then is described much more fully in texts, in a movement within Buddhism that came to be called the Great Way or the Mahayana. The key figure is the Bodhisattva. The Mahayana focuses around the Bodhisattva. So the Mahayana Buddhism is the kind of Buddhism you find in China, in Japan, Korea, Taiwan, also in a particular form in Tibet, where it's kind of developed into something else, really, but it's based in Mahayana. And so the Bodhisattva, so the Mahayana describes the Bodhisattva in a range of these ancient texts, which are called Mahayana Sutras. And they're very, very famous in Asia. There's the Lotus Sutra, the Avatamsaka Sutra, and the Sutra of Golden Light. And we study these in Triratna because Sangharakshita, who was ordained as a Theravadan monk, it was always very, very inspired by this vision of human potential that you find in Mahayana Buddhism. Okay? So, the Bodhisattva vows, suffering beings are numberless, I vow to liberate them all. Attachment is inexhaustible, I vow to release it all. The gates to truth are numberless, I vow to master them all. The way to awakening... way to awakening is supreme. I vow to realize it. So, what's all this saying? It's saying that the only thing that's worth doing in life is something that takes us beyond who we are already. We're kind of genetically programmed to look after ourselves, to pass on our genes, and to look after our best interests. And the core insight of Buddhism is that that's all well and good, but actually there's something in that that leads us to suffer. And not only does it lead us to suffer, it leads everyone to suffer. And it leads us to cause each other to suffer. So when we think about our lives and what's worth doing in our lives, we need to think beyond the possibilities of what we already know, beyond what our instincts tell us even, beyond what we can imagine by expanding the scope of our imagination. If I care about myself, then I know what I'm dealing with. If I care about myself and my family and maybe my friends, then that's a wider sphere of sympathy. If I, and I could expand that to say, well, I care about my country, I care about my community. How about I care about my race? Now we're getting into slightly more difficult territory, aren't we? So what the Bodhisattva ideal grows from is an idea about what altruism is. And altruism isn't concerned with limiting the sphere of our sympathies. It's saying, I care because I have an open-hearted attitude towards the world. My open-hearted concern for others isn't limited in any of these ways, like saying, I care about my family, but not about your family, for example. It's an open-hearted attitude. And if it's open-hearted, and I'm not going to put limits on it, it's the seed of something that is so all-encompassing that I can't possibly understand or articulate it. An open-hearted, boundless attitude will very rapidly hit paradox. So the Bodhisattva vow says, though all beings are, though beings are numberless, I vow to save them all. So how is that possible? The answer is, it's not possible. And yet, that's what I undertake to do. Because if I were to say, beings are numberless, I vow to save some of them, I would be putting an artificial limit on my compassion. But the nature of compassion is that it is boundless. So the Bodhisattva vows embrace that paradox. They challenge us to think bigger than the biggest thought we can possibly entertain. And that might not be very big, actually. But the challenge is that, however big our thoughts are. And all of this is what we find in the sources of the Bodhisattva ideal. This kind of mind-boggling, expansive scope of what it is we're dealing with when we sit down on a meditation cushion. That's what you find in the Mahayana Sutras. And in a slightly different way, or in a connected way, that's what you find in these archetypal bodhisattvas. So I've already been talking about the boggling of the mind. How can we possibly comprehend that? And another, maybe there's another element we need to bring in before we can talk about those bodhisattvas, actually, which is that if what I'm describing here is the idea that I, me, little old me, is going to save the world, not only is that mind-boggling, it seems profoundly egotistical. It's a kind of megalomaniac delusion that I will become the saviour of humanity and the supreme being of the cosmos. Well, really. So it's not concerned with that. It's opening our mind to forces that go beyond our ego. And it entertains the idea that when we do that, we connect with forces that are not exactly me in the universe. And the key concept here is the bodhicitta. So the bodhicitta means the will or intention to enlightenment, which I can have, but which is not mine. It's inherent somehow in the nature of existence. And so what is that? So that's the bodhicitta. And the arising of the bodhicitta is what makes you a bodhisattva. So what does that look like? That's where we come to these archetypal figures. What does that look like? It looks like a figure that embodies wisdom, let's say. It embodies wisdom in the figure of a prince. Young, beautiful, and with a kind of delicate but unstoppable power that is located in his sword. The sword he holds beside him, and the sword flickers with flame. And it's a sword that can cut through any delusion, any ignorance. Maybe it looks like that's Manjushri, that the figure with the sword. Perhaps it looks like a being who cares so much that he has exploded. His head has burst into 11 heads that look in all directions. His arms have, two weren't enough, so more sprouted. Four arms, each holding an implement, or 1,000 arms, an array of arms in a halo, a wheel around him, each of them holding an implement that can reach out to help people. Perhaps that's what it looks like. So there's an array of these figures that we find in Mahayana Buddhism, also in the Vajrayana Buddhism that we have in Tibet. And these are another dimension of the Bodhisattva ideal. So the Bodhisattva captures all of these dimensions. Gautama the Buddha, Gautama the Bodhisattva, who is on his way to the Buddha, the legendary Buddha, who has all of these qualities, the Buddha on his way to becoming the legendary Buddha in all of his previous lives, where he sacrifices himself and develops the virtues, the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas of the sutras, and the archetypal Bodhisattvas who embody the Bodhisattva vow and embody the timeless wisdom. These are all dimensions of the Bodhisattva ideal, but it also comes back to us and our practice. And thinking of these figures and thinking of the Bodhisattva challenges us to see where our sympathies end and to expand the sphere of our sympathies to include more beings, more people. And not just people, animals as well. Where our imagination ends in terms of what we think a human life can become. And the where the Buddhist tradition then informs that is by giving a language and by giving a practice, which is the Bodhisattva path. Okay, I'll stop there.